FBI. Director Kash Patel appeared before a House committee this week and made a commitment that the committee, and frankly, most of Washington, will be watching closely. He vowed to release the names associated with the Epstein investigation. The hearing was, by multiple accounts, contentious. Separately, the House Oversight Committee released the transcript of a closed-door interview with Catherine Ruemmler, a former Obama White House counsel, in which she acknowledged making a joke about an Epstein massage in testimony.
The Epstein story has remarkable staying power in American political culture. More than 7 years after Epstein's death, it continues to generate congressional hearings, document releases, and political controversy. The names that Patel has promised to release, assuming he follows through, will land in an already polarized environment where the story has been used by different factions for completely different political purposes. What gets released and when will be as politically calibrated as anything else coming out of the current FBI leadership.
Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell's situation is becoming one of the stranger political dramas in recent Senate history. A CNN or SSRS poll released Thursday found his favorability at just 11% after 7 weeks away from the Senate floor. 11%. That's not a political low point. That's statistical outlier territory. And when reporters asked his aide about video proof of life, actual evidence that the 84-year-old senator is in good health, the aide declined to answer.
The political mechanics here are important. McConnell's seat is a Kentucky Senate seat, and his prolonged absence is creating procedural complications. Senate Republicans have a majority they need to maintain and exercise. If McConnell cannot return to full capacity, the question of resignation, appointment of a successor, and who controls that process in Frankfurt becomes a live political question. Trump has already named a preferred candidate for Lindsey Graham's South Carolina seat and is facing GOP pushback there. So the dynamics of Senate seat succession are very much in play nationally.
The Thomas Trump legal maneuver is also worth noting. Justice Clarence Thomas unilaterally granted the Trump legal team until September 9th to petition the Supreme Court to revive the president's lawsuit against Hillary Clinton. Thomas acting alone on this is procedurally normal. A single justice can grant extensions on petition deadlines. But the optics are predictably controversial given the ongoing questions about Thomas's recusals and relationships with Trump allies.
On the broader ideological landscape, the CNN poll finding that 1 in 3 Democrats now identify as Democratic Socialists is a significant data point. That's not a fringe position within the party anymore, if 33% of self-identified Democrats claim that label. Bernie Sanders dismissed Fetterman's call this week for the progressive movement to stop backing far-left candidates, essentially saying the movement is not going to retreat. That internal Democratic tension between the Sanders wing and the more centrist Fetterman-type figures will shape the 2028 primary dynamics in fundamental ways.
Senator Grassley's warning about Social Security deserves more attention than it's getting. He said that under current projections, the Social Security Trust Fund will be depleted by 2032. Triggering an automatic 22% cut in benefits for all recipients, not just new enrollees, but everyone currently receiving benefits. That's not a political opinion. It's what current law requires when the trust fund runs out. A 22% cut to Social Security would be the largest single reduction in American retirement income in the program's history.
The Sanders-Grassley bill to fine the Pentagon for failing its audits is one of those rare, genuine bipartisan moments. The Pentagon has failed its financial audit 5 consecutive years. 5 years of a massive federal agency being unable to account for its own assets and expenditures. The proposal to impose financial penalties is mostly symbolic. The fines would come from the Pentagon's own budget, but it's forcing a conversation about accountability that the defense establishment would prefer to avoid.
The Georgia story, a third state lawmaker pleading guilty to COVID unemployment fraud, reflects the ongoing cleanup from the extraordinary fiscal chaos of the pandemic relief period. Georgia has now had 3 state legislators caught defrauding the same unemployment system. It suggests the oversight mechanisms were inadequate across the board, and the legal reckoning is still playing out years later.
Before we get into our curriculum corner here, because antitrust is going to come up in our AI discussion, let me give listeners a quick grounding in how antitrust law actually works, because it's relevant to understanding the AI concentration story. The bedrock is the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which does two main things. Section 1 prohibits agreements between competitors that restrain trade, things like price-fixing cartels. Section 2 prohibits monopolization, which legally means something very specific. Being a monopoly isn't itself illegal under U.S. law. What's illegal is using monopoly power to exclude competitors in ways that harm consumers or innovation. The classic test is whether a company has the ability to control prices or exclude competition in a relevant market. Market share matters, but isn't sufficient. Microsoft held over 90% of the PC operating system market in the 1990s antitrust case, but the government also had to prove they used that dominance to illegally foreclose competition, specifically by forcing PC makers to bundle Internet Explorer and exclude Netscape. You need both the market position and the conduct. So when regulators look at, say, Google's dominance in search or Meta's position in social networking, the legal question isn't, do they have a big market share? It's, are they leveraging that position to prevent rivals from competing fairly? The distinction matters enormously for how any future AI antitrust case would be constructed.